Hello there, you, and welcome to the Culturefile Weekly with me, Luke Clancy, and in the larder this time, local folk horror in a new Irish feature, All You Need Is Death. Jennifer Walsh attempts to recall the colours of old Ireland without help from the AI. Soprano Laura Bowler manages to sing while getting tattooed in her new work, Advert, and Deirdre O'Mahony's eco-opera film, The Quickening, starts a tour of walls and halls. But we start in the scary place. When the restored print of pioneering 1982 Irish folk horror film The Outcast had its premiere screening recently, the expert called upon to introduce the film and the genre at the Irish Film Institute in Dublin was our guest this time, Paul Dwan. Dwan has more than a casual interest in folk horror, a popular again genre of brooding darkness in the cinema. Dwan's debut feature, a self-funded film, All You Need Is Death, out next week, is a contemporary milestone in the Irish variant of the genre. Working with Lancome's Ian Lynch, Dwan focused on the music of horror, creating a story about a cursed folk song and its singers. He spoke to Culturefile's Quaylen McNamara about folk and film funding.
My name is Paul Dwan. I'm a producer, writer, director, filmmaker, I guess. And I've just completed a new film called All You Need Is Death. There's a genre called folk horror that's very popular at the moment, and I realised that nobody had really leaned into the folk music side of folk horror. And because of the current wave of really extraordinary groups, music, happening in Ireland, you know, Lancome, Lisa O'Neill, John Francis Flynn, Oxen, I kind of felt that the music could carry the story in a way that would really work for a horror movie. So I started to work on a story that would work with that kind of music. And it's a story about a couple of young song collectors who are looking for rare and untranslated songs and who accidentally find themselves recording a song that was never meant to be recorded or translated and has a curse on it that goes back to centuries into the past. I love music and the current scene, the music scene in Ireland. I've been a fan. I've been going to see Lancome. I've been going to see the Mary Wallopers for years now, really. I ended up doing a couple of videos for the Wallopers. They're good friends of mine now. And I've also worked with Ian Lynch from Lancome. I did a video for his solo project, One Leg, One Eye. So yeah, when I made the film, I was able to call on these people. Ian Lynch of Lancome did the soundtrack. It's his first soundtrack for a film. Dara Lynch, his brother, is in the film. So is Roisin from the Mary Wallopers and various other kinds of people from the music scene. Barry Gleason, brother of Brendan, who is a well-known ballad singer on the scene in Dublin. He has his first acting role in the film. So yeah, I mean, I just was able to use my kind of friendship or, you know, connection with some of these people to bring them on board and to get them to bring something to the film. I knew early on that unless I could work with somebody who was extremely gifted musically and who understood the kind of the nature of what I was trying to do, that it wouldn't work. The first person I sent the script to when it was finished was Ian Lynch. And if Ian had said, you know what, I don't think this is any good, I probably would have had to reconsider what I was doing. Because Ian's interests, I mean, he's an academic with a degree in folklore. He understands Old Irish, which is important to the film. And he's also a huge fan of the horror genre, fan of H.P. Lovecraft and Poe, and all those things are very important to the film. So Ian's input, I've said many times that I consider him a 50% collaborator in the film. His music is at least, it's half of the experience of watching the film.
Some of us are drawn to the flame.
I was definitely thinking about the kind of, you know, growing up in a kind of a sort of semi-pagan kind of country, because when I was a kid, you know, we played in fairy forts, we knew about the little people, you knew not to damage a fairy fort, you knew about pishogues and superstitions, you know, all those things, but they're not made a big deal of. It's not like, it's just, it's there. So I was kind of aware of that, I think, more than any. I wasn't trying to dig into specific Irish myths. I mean, people have tried to do their banshees or their whatever, and I kind of felt like it can feel a bit hokey, so I kind of invented my own story, my own folklore, my own kind of world for the story to take place in, and it's very much based around song and based around folk songs. So you know, it's definitely original, and it isn't like anything else you've seen. Whether that's a good thing or a bad thing, we'll find out soon. People have watched it and told me that it's come back to them in their nightmares and their dreams. People have said it's very unsettling, it's very creepy, it gets under your skin. And that's good. I mean, I didn't want to make a kind of a jump scare movie or a gore movie or a slasher movie. They're not things I'm interested in. I wanted to make something that had an atmosphere that you haven't really seen before in a film. And, you know, it's a very, very Irish film. And it is, I think it kind of partakes of some of the same kind of thing you feel when you listen to a Lancome record and you feel the kind of the darkness and the mystery of Irish folklore and culture in there in the music.
Know what Fuegasa means?
I do.
The song has no name. But if it did have a name, it would be Love is a Knife with a Blade for a Handle.
There's a lot of singing in the film. Yeah, Alwyn Fowler sings centrally, a very powerful scene where she sings this taboo song that's been handed down from mother to daughter for generations and generations and is in a language that nobody understands anymore. My female lead, Simone Collins, sings, and she's got an amazing voice, which I wasn't... I knew she could sing, but the first time I actually heard her was when we were actually on set filming, so it was a good surprise. I'm very lucky because the terrific American distributor XYZ Films is releasing my film worldwide, and they also make films. They made Mandy, they made The Raid, they made Vivarium here with an Irish director, Lorcan Finnegan, and they've already seen two of my next two, you know, outlines for the two things I want to do next, and they've committed themselves to being involved. Yeah, so it looks like with their support I'll continue. As I say, it depends on whether I can find any matching funding here in Ireland, but theoretically there is quite a lot of money here in Ireland, just whether they're willing to give it to me or not, we'll see. I had to make the film with the money I had because Screen Ireland were not giving me any money for any of my projects, and I kind of felt, well, I'm going to make a film one way or the other, so I took what I had in the bank and made the film. The budget dictated the scale of the film, it dictated the scope. Within what we had, there's very little that I would go back and say I want to do that differently, but nobody elects to make a film with no money. It's very, very difficult, and it was a very stressful and heartbreaking and painful experience making a film with no money, and I'm still have no money still because of it. When the film sells, yes, the money will come back, which is going to be great, but it's just I don't think it's fair really for filmmakers to be expected to do this. And I think what you'll find, there's more and more Irish filmmakers coming out with self-funded films. Lance Daly, who made Black 47, is self-funding his next film. The guy who made Cardboard Gangsters, Mark O'Connor, is self-funding his next film. It's really, really weird that successful Irish filmmakers like that find themselves forced down the route of making films for no money when there's a very, very well-funded film funding body in Ireland that just doesn't seem to be interested in giving us money. But that's the way things are right now.
Paul Dwan there, and the reporter was Quailan McNamara. All You Need Is Death premieres at the IFI Dublin on the 19th of April, with the director and Ian Lynch in conversation afterwards. If there's one thing that beats the adrenaline rush of debuting daring new music, says mezzo-soprano and composer Laura Bowler, it's debuting daring new music while getting a tattoo. In her new work, Advert, which gets its Irish premiere as part of New Music Dublin later this month, Bowler does just that, with the help of an on-stage tattoo artist. But it's not even the most unexpected length she's gone to for a performance. In a previous piece written for her by Jennifer Walsh, she committed not just to doing some boxing, but to becoming a boxer, as Laura Bowler explained to Culture File.
I, for some reason, decided that I wanted to commission a work to celebrate the inclusion of women's boxing for the first time in the Commonwealth Games. And at the beginning of the score, it was like, you know, soloist shadow boxes for 3 minutes. And one of the things about the whole piece is that basically it's fundamentally saying, well, women box. It's just watching a woman box go through a training process. And obviously that meant I needed to look convincing as a boxer, because otherwise it would undermine the entire concept of the work. So I thought, oh dear, I really need to do something about this. So basically I contacted loads of boxing trainers. I was living in London at the time. I was like, I'm doing this project. It's about women's boxing. And then I was so fortunate that Kathy Brown, also known as Kathy the Bitch Brown, she offered to train me, and she trained me pretty much kind of almost full time for 3 months. And I changed my diet. I changed everything about my lifestyle. And boxing basically became my life for 3 months. It was a phenomenal experience. Like, I can honestly say by the end of it, I felt like a superhero. I felt so powerful and so strong. And it was a really amazing insight into what it means to have your body be such a different thing for you. Although my body's important to me as a vocalist, it's a very different thing in relationship to being a boxer, and also going through the process of being hit in the face and hitting someone else in the face was something, thankfully, I'd never experienced before. And that was a really hard barrier for me. Like, I remember being in the ring sparring for the first time, and Kathy was like, you just need to punch him, just punch him in the face, right? And this bloke was standing there, and I was like, I can't do it, I cannot make myself do it. And she was like, well, he's just going to punch you then if you don't punch him first. and then he did, and I was like, right. So it was a really, yeah, it was a fascinating process. It started off a really significant kind of route and narrative in my own work and the own works that I write for myself. Like, if it wasn't for performing that piece, I don't think I'd be where I am as a composer now. Like, it had such a huge influence on me.
Part of the motivation here, you were saying that, you know, maybe people who aren't sort of in the new music scene might find, or classical music, might find it kind of unapproachable and not that interesting. And literally, you are thinking about adding interest for those people.
Yeah, no, of course. I think it's really important. Like, I'm from a non-musical family, from Stoke-on-Trent, which is a working class town in the UK. And most of the people that are from my hometown don't really even know that composers write the strange music that I write nowadays. It's such a different world and reality that is important to me. And it's important to find ways for people to kind of feel like they can access the work, and that it doesn't feel too alienating in any way. And so obviously with the boxing work with Jenny, what was really interesting about the performances is that all of these people that obviously Kathy knew, and also people that I'd met doing the boxing training in gyms and various places, the audience was full of new music enthusiasts and like gym bods and boxers. And I just love that. Like, the experience of mixing those two different cultures was fantastic. And I think that's makes it all the more exciting. That's what theatre is really about. And sometimes I think we can forget about that in kind of the experimental new music scene. And certainly with my work since then, you know, video has been a huge factor. And that's because, more people are more visually kind of stimulated rather than maybe orally. And so it's another pathway. It's kind of holding out a hand and going, here's a way in. Hopefully it will help you to get on board. I'm very interested in tattooing and what it means and why people get tattoos, and why I got a tattoo for the first time. It wasn't until I was 27, so it's quite late. The piece is all about kind of how we advertise ourselves to our chosen kind of societal tribes, what things we do, the way we dress, the way we talk, the music we listen to, the films we watch. Tattoos are obviously an aspect of that. And for me, obviously, they're a huge part of my identity, as I've got them in, all over my body. So that's one of the reasons why the piece is in it. But also, I was generally just really interested in how it would affect me whilst I was singing, to be tattooed at the same time as singing, and the viscerality of that, both for the audience, but also for me as a performer, and what that kind of stimulates in you energy-wise as you're performing. Julia Rehmer, she's a fantastic artist, and she's based in Leipzig in Germany. I have to say, the first time I did it, the first time we rehearsed it, where she actually tattooed me for the first time while singing, I was so conscious of not moving too much for her that basically I wasn't breathing properly at all. And I almost passed out at the end of the section because I just hadn't been breathing really at all. And she was like, it's really fine. You can move a bit. The only thing I can liken it to is actually when I did my first boxing fight. So I did a boxing fight at Your Call, which was after doing the performance of Jenny's piece. I just fell in love with boxing and I started boxing for quite a long time. And when I did my first fight, Kathy, my trainer, warned me. She said, you won't be able to sleep after fighting, just so you know. And I was like, what? I'm used to performing. I'll be fine. I'm used to adrenaline. I've got this. No, a whole other level of adrenaline comes with being in a boxing fight. Oh my God. And so that's the closest thing I can relate it to, is that combination of the two different kinds of adrenaline that you get is just being absolutely wired, totally wired and horrifically exhausted the next day.
Laura Bowler there, and she'll perform that tattoo piece advert at the National Concert Hall in Dublin on Thursday, the 25th of April. newmusicdublin.ie for all the details. Now, regular listeners and perhaps lucky irregulars could easily remember that we've been checking in on artist Deirdre O'Mahony's long-term project exploring food and agriculture in Ireland. Well, that project has come to ripeness in The Quickening, a kind of cinema opera which is now screening at the Douglas Hyde Gallery in Dublin, but is also about to set off to smaller venues around the country for what the artist calls a walls and halls tour of rural venues. Culture Files' Quailin McNamara went to the Dublin launch to meet the artist and her collaborators.
My name is Deirdre O'Mahony. I'm a visual artist and we're here in the Douglas Hyde Gallery in Trinity College, Dublin. Today, my new work, The Quickening, is opening in the Douglas Hyde. And this is primarily a film, a 36-minute film, which captures the voices of a representative selection of stakeholders involved in food production and consumption and policy. It's the outcome of a three-year project I did called the Sustainment Experiments that looked at different ways of engaging farmers, scientists, policymakers. What I wanted to do was create a kind of public space where people who wouldn't normally rub shoulders get to sit side by side and share food and their thoughts and opinions on what it means to farm, what it means to grow food, what it means as a scientist to look at the consequences of certain kinds of agricultural practices. And the outcome was 18 hours of conversations that were then painstakingly transcribed by a young artist called Fiona Gannon. And that transcription is an over 300-page document that is downstairs in the gallery. And it's a snapshot of the opinions shared over the table at those two meals.
Dung beetles break down manure. Their mites feed on flies who compete with the beetles.
I thought that by having people sing the words as opposed to repeating them or having actors repeat them, that it would defamiliarize them sufficiently to allow us to hear what people are saying in a different way.
Turn organic matter into plant nutrients.
I had been working with a regenerative farmer called Susanna Crampton in Kilkenny, on the shores, or in Thomastown in Kilkenny. And Susanna farms for dung beetles, because dung beetles play such a pivotal role in maintaining healthy soil. John Brennan and I recorded the dung beetles on her farms. We recorded the soil life, the microbial life. We recorded ants marching. It was quite extraordinary. And so in the film, I wanted to make the voices of the non-human world heard also. And that's the kind of duet that plays out over the course of the film.
In the agricultural industry, the only life.
I'm a singer, Siobhan Kavanagh, based in Dublin. I started working with Deirdre, I'd say about a year ago now. It's been amazing to work with a huge collective of musicians. So it's been a really beautiful process. We started out mapping it, looking at the different issues and how we might tell the story of the content with music, and kind of looking at the strengths of the different musicians and kind of thinking, could they be that voice? Would that instrument sound bit on that, are good on that part? So it's a lot of arrangement. It's kind of Irish traditional music put in a blender, which is, I think, all of the music makers on the piece all come from experimental backgrounds. Even if we are traditional, like, time to time, we all kind of blend it, you know? So it's definitely, it wouldn't be just kind of in a traditional box.
I think everyone should be interested in food production and farming.
Our every action has consequences. The personal is not just political, it's the future of our children and our children's children. If we don't take action now, we're in real trouble. I'm trying to muster every tool that I can as an artist. I want to both seduce and engage and enthrall audiences. I want to engage politicians. I want to engage the policymakers. I really want to engage the policymakers of the future to come and to see the film and look at the programme of events that's happening.
There's no holistic thinking.
There's no holistic thinking.
And get involved.
Long term.
It's not long term.
It's not long term.
Deirdre O'Mahony there at the Douglas Hyde Gallery, where The Quickening is screening until June. The Walls and Halls tour runs from April 18th to May 4th, starting at Rathanna Community Hall, Carlow, and finishing in Blackbird Culture Lab, Wexford. Check out Culturefile on Blue Sky for details of all the stops. How many of the 40 shades of green are familiar to an AI? What shade of sash might it imagine my father wore? What will it display of the gamut of the rare old times? Our correspondent Jennifer Walsh recently leafed through one of John Breslin and Sarah Ann Buckley's best-selling compilations of colourised photos of the country's past, Old Ireland in Colour, an activity which inevitably brings attention to the nature of knowing and remembering. This is Jennifer Walsh's Things Know Things.
Back in the 1980s, my aunt took some photographs of my grandmother and great-grandmother to be copied professionally. There were precious few photos of these women, all in black and white, a little dog-eared and very much beloved. The photography studio offered my aunt the option to have the photos colourised, and she jumped at the chance. When she brought the prints home, we saw that the colourisation involved someone at the photography studio making crude guesses, painting a flush on my grandmother's cheeks, a layer of pink lipstick on her lips. Grandma's blouse now appeared to be blue. The backdrop she stood against was yellow. My aunt was pleased, but as a child, I found these photos disturbing. How could the photographer possibly know what the correct colours were? My elderly female relatives rarely wore lipstick, and when they did, it was orange, never pink. My aunt hung both the black and white and the colourised photos side by side on the wall, and I would compare them over and over, wondering at the gap between what I regarded as the true olden days world of black and white and the uncanny modern guess at colour. I thought of these pictures recently as I spent many hours looking through the photos in John Breslin and Sarah Ann Buckley's Old Ireland in Colour books. You may well have seen some of the photos from this project floating around the web. Pictures dating from the 1840s through to the 1960s of Aran Islanders fishing, Free State generals, women lugging turf on ackle, etc. The real pull, though, is not the thoughtful curation. It's that the photos have been colourised using an AI-powered platform called Deoldify. The photos included in Old Ireland in Colour provide a fascinating look at Irish life, and the colourisation serves to instantly make the photos feel more vivid, to highlight details you might otherwise miss. The blue of the tram navigating the rubble of O'Connell Street after the 1916 rising. The lavender stone in W.B. Yeats's Ring. The mustard grey and red of women's shawls. The 1930s streets turned loud and garish. Now the advertisements jump out at you in colour. It's not just AI. Research plays a role too, with Breslin and Buckley explaining that where appropriate, they corrected certain colours. For example, Deoldify rendered Constance Markovich's uniform navy and purple when the historical record notes that it was bottle green. Tom Crean's Arran jumpers were rendered in lilac, which wouldn't look out of place in fashion now, but was certainly not the case at the time. Most notable for me, though, was that the network's choices do not occur in the service of unfiltered realism. They create an aesthetic. Old Ireland in Colour is meticulously researched, but it is not neutral in a colour grading sense. The pictures have a distinctive palette. They give the impression of a past where everything is muted, soft, full of earth tones. So much heather, lavender, rifle green, olive drab, so much dusty mauve, ecru, taupe. The skin of the people depicted is often peachy, creamy. The tans on the oarsmen of the Waterford Boat Club look sunnily Californian. It seems the complementary colour palette to John Hine's oversaturated, psychedelic view of Ireland. Old Ireland in Colour is a great feat of technology and research and has, understandably, brought a lot of people joy. But I find myself asking new versions of the questions I asked of grandma's photos as a child. What am I looking at when I look at these pictures? What choices am I witnessing? Am I seeing Peg Sayers or an early 20th century eviction or the smiles of children on the baskets with fresh eyes? Or am I seeing the dream that technology can somehow give us back the past, can wipe away the years and loss and make the dead feel alive, make grandma look young again? Am I seeing the colorization that makes that dream visible and the knowledge that the wrong colour lipstick will always be worth it?
Jennifer Walsh's Things No Things there, and as I've been known to mention, all of Jennifer's previous essays exploring the ways in which AI is seeping into our world are available via podcast. Just follow Culturefile on your favourite podcast app. And that brings to a close this edition of the Culturefile Weekly. We'll be back with more artificial shades next Saturday tea time. Till then, bye now.